length of bandwidth that you use to measure the noise power that's in the side lobes of that imperfect oscillator. So the way you rate it, once again, is how many kilohertz or hertz on the one side, how many hertz or one kilohertz off to one side, above or below the carrier, how many dB down, that's the dBc, and then you have to also tell the guy what was the bandwidth with which you made the measurement. You may have made the measurement with a 10 hertz filter. Many spectrum analyzers, the sharpest filter it's got is 10 hertz. Well, the way noise works, every time you divide the bandwidth by 2, you see half the amount of noise power. Or divide by 10, you see 1/10 the noise power. So even though you made the measurement with a 10 hertz resolution bandwidth filter on your spectrum analyzer, which is scanning across that frame, you could still readjust the numbers by 10 to 1 in decibels, 10 dB added or subtracted, because you are giving the reading in dBc per hertz. That's the standard. Most people use per hertz, not per 10 hertz or not per kilohertz, although you could. The most popular way of rating spectral purity, it's called, or oscillator quality, is in units of dBc per hertz at some offset frequency from the carrier. So if you wanted to do a complete specification of an oscillator, you would talk about how strong is the noise 100 hertz away, how strong is the noise 1 kilohertz away, how strong is the noise 10 kilohertz away, how strong is the hertz 100, the noise 100 kilohertz away. You give all of those numbers, and now you've completely described the quality of that particular oscillator. The reason this is important is that if your receiver has a pure oscillator, it listens to one and only one frequency, in theory, and you're happy. As the quality of your oscillator gets worse, and you create more and more of these side lobes, a couple of things happen. Your receiver is now generating some noise of its oscillator that the rest of your receiver is going to think is signal, and so it's going to hurt sensitivity a little bit. Second of all, if there's a nearby strong signal, that if you had a pure crystal oscillator and you listen to 146.85 and there's another repeater on 146.75, no problem. But if the oscillator of your receiver is broad enough, low enough in quality, that it's got a significant amount of energy at that other frequency, you're going to be listening to two channels at once. You're going to be hearing interference. So quality of oscillator is important when it comes to dynamic range, current selectivity, sensitivity. Also, as the oscillator becomes lower and lower in quality, the signal you listen to on an FM signal might It will have this residual phase modulated noise of your oscillator superimposed on the signal that comes out of your earphones or your loudspeaker. As far as the IF strip is concerned, he is seeing a phase modulated signal. Whether the modulated signal in the IF happened because the signal you're listening to was phase modulated, or if the phase modulation came from the local oscillator of that mixer that generated the IF strip, the IF strip can't tell the difference. It's going to give you the sound of both. And so if that oscillator gets low enough in quality, it's going to be unhappy. So good synthesizers come very close to the quality of a crystal oscillator. Maybe that helps. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. All right. I'll see if I can say a few words also on this that may help understanding. It is a very useful, basically, if you're looking at a radio, a new radio, and the review is the ARRL. Basically, how they do the review is they calculate the dBc that you see there, and you notice it's usually somewhere between minus 110 to maybe even as much as 100, minus 160. And how they do it basically is they have a transmit, or not a transmit, but a signal source, nearby signal source in their laboratory that is the known phase noise characteristic. In other words, they have a standard, and that's what they use to measure with. So if you compare the their measurement with the number of the radios in the same class, let's say you're looking for a radio in a certain class, you know, the number of manufacturers making the same radio, they're price-wise, they're almost the same. And the characteristics are very similar, and you're really looking into the receiver. So this phase noise measurement can be a very important part of determining which radio you're going to buy. Let me let it drop in a second. Now, how do they get these things? There is a formula that is called the QRF formula. They more or less hit upon it, where it takes the noise level plus 10, which means 10 dB, times the log of the bandwidth of the IF, and that comes up with the figure, and this is how they factor into this figure the final measurement, but that's a little bit on the complicated side. But what you have to do is really look at what they'll do is they'll tell you the offset frequency, attenuation, and then the ratio of V2 to V1, and then in a column they'll give you the phase noise. So you're looking at that for the specification. In other words, get down the list. And it usually gives you offset frequency for a number of different tests. So that's basically the what you're looking for on a radio over.
Yeah, it turns out that if the local oscillator spectral purity is what it's called, or phase noise, or residual phase noise, it's got a whole lot of names. But if the oscillator is not high enough in quality, it will affect your spur free dynamic range. It will have a little bit of a effect on sensitivity. It will have a lot of effect on blocking dynamic range, adjacent channel rejection. It will have a lot of impact on it. Because a super heterodyne receiver is so dependent on that first and second oscillator, if it's a dual conversion type, the quality of that oscillator is one of the major factors determining an awful lot of the quality of the performance of that receiver. The rest of the receiver can be gold-plated, and if you've got a really yucky oscillator in the front end of the receiver, you're probably going to be pretty unhappy. So they do that measurement. It's actually done with a phase noise test set when it comes to the really high performance measurement. When it comes to the medium performance measurement, a high-quality spectrum analyzer can do the measurement. But in some cases, what they do to measure the residual phase noise of an oscillator is to take the oscillator in question, multiply it to a much higher frequency, multiply it by 2, 4, 10, 20, and then look at the results. The reason they do that is when you take angular modulation of a signal, doesn't matter if it's phase or frequency modulation. If it's angular modulation and not amplitude modulation we're talking about, when you multiply the frequency, the modulation also gets multiplied. So however wide that signal was at the fundamental frequency, which may be too narrow to make a precise measurement of it, you multiply that signal 10 times, the modulation index gets multiplied by 10 times. Now you look at that with a good piece of test equipment, and you have a lot more resolution of this phenomenon. And then, of course, whatever results you've got to do some mathematics to reflect it back down to what it would have been. The nice thing about multiplying the frequency is now you can make the measurement with a 10 hertz, 100 hertz, or 1 kilohertz bandwidth filter in the spectrum analyzer. It's an easy measurement to make because now the signal has become much wider in its bandwidth, so to speak, that you see on the screen. and then it's a lot easier to reflect it back down to what it would have been if you had that ideal 1 hertz filter to make the measurement of the
repeater. Timeout.
See, very few pieces of equipment, test equipment, have a 1 hertz resolution filter. Some of the fancy digital signal processing kinds of test equipment can synthesize the equivalent of a 1 hertz filter. But to really build a 1 hertz filter into a spectrum analyzer is a heroic effort, and it would be hard to use because you have to scan very slowly not to create an impulse response of that very narrow filter. To scan across 10 kilohertz with a 1 hertz filter will take you 10,000 seconds, and I'm not kidding. And even then, you're going to be smearing the answer a little bit. So you can see why very few pieces of the test equipment really have a 1 hertz.
We said no transmitter.
What about the transmitter?
You're probably timing out the transmitter.
Okay. I'm listening to the transmitter on 146.85. Maybe the 375 is being timed out. Maybe I should give some more delays. So, the bottom line of all this is that the quality of the oscillator determines a lot of the other factors that get measured in a good receiver. Very few engineers have a good understanding of this measurement technique. It's called spectral purity measurement. It's called residual phase noise measurement, residual angular modulation of the oscillator. It's called all kinds of things. It's got lots and lots of names. Each one of them tries to convey what's being measured. But you really, as Mel was saying, you've got a standard which quite often is a crystal oscillator. Very few oscillators are higher in quality than a well-done crystal oscillator. And you're comparing that gold standard to your voltage-controlled oscillator as part of your phase lock loop, as part of your frequency synthesizer, and there's more than one way to make synthesizers, by the way, direct and indirect. We won't go there, but each has its advantages and disadvantages. Almost every transceiver we use today has frequency synthesizers for the transmitter and for the receiver. So we're very dependent on these synthesizers. We're very dependent on the quality of those synthesizers. I've done quite a bit of investigation of the local oscillator circuit, the voltage control, the tuning circuit that's in this Kenwood TS711A. That's one of the best ones I've seen in a long time. But it's an old piece of equipment. A few of the pieces of equipment that have come along over the years since then were not so good. Nowadays, because of these rating systems that you've got in QSC Magazine and other places, the manufacturers have caught on that the hams are voting with their pocketbook, and they better spend some effort and put a good synthesizer into their transceiver. Otherwise, the amateurs are not going to buy it. K2KUY, K2LIW.
Very good. This is K2KUY. Dick just hit upon a very good point you just touched upon. Let me just emphasize one more thing, that a lot of the tests are also made. You got to also notice if it's with the filter on and filter off. The dynamic range of a number of these radios, say, is enhanced quite a bit because they have what we call a higher dynamic range because of the sharp crystal filter that is placed usually right after what we call the first mixer in the receiver. So the tests that are made, because by placing that filter in there, you can improve, for instance, the noise level considerably with either the, you put in the CW or the sideband filter. You'll notice that a number of the tests will specify filter on or filter off. So that is when you make the comparison, look for those two also, whether the filter is inserted or the filter is out. So that gives you basically another test of the quality of the receiver. So always look for those specifications, like the filters. For instance, if it's a 2.5 kilohertz sideband filter, whether it's in or out, that will influence the phase noise measurements. I think that's the simplest way to put it, Dick, over.
You've gotten into another whole significant area here, Mel. What bandwidth of the final resolution filter in the IF strip, whether it be 2KZ, 3KZ, wide for sideband reception, or whether it be the 500 hertz filter for Morse code reception, that makes a difference in dynamic range and selectivity. Some of the good rigs also have something called a roofing filter, which is really the filter in the vicinity of the mixer that goes into the first IF, and whether or not they spend some money putting high quality and skirt selectivity into that filter, which is called the roofing filter. They give it that name because some people will say that the dynamic range is really the difference between the floor and the ceiling of where the radio works. The floor is the sensitivity, the noise at the bottom, and the ceiling is the stronger signal it can tolerate before becoming nonlinear. Some people call it the floor and the ceiling. Some people call it the floor and the roof. The roofing filter is important. Also, some of these rigs will have a pre-amplifier that you've got a button on the front panel. When you push it, the pre-amplifier is turned on and turned off. You turn on the pre-amplifier to lower the noise figure and to increase the gain in the front end. That's the good news. But turning on the pre-amplifier always lowers the dynamic range. It makes a few dB of improvement in sensitivity, but it makes a lot of dB of detriment in the stronger signal you can tolerate. You turn on a 15 decibel gain preamplifier, and in general, your receiver will saturate 15 dB sooner. The preamplifier may have increased your sensitivity by 8 dB, but you've lost 15 dB of strong signal tolerance, so you've only come out 7 dB ahead in the difference between sensitivity. You've lost 15 dB of dynamic range on the high end, and you gained 7 dB in my example of sensitivity in the low end, so I think you've taken an 8 dB hit in dynamic range. So whether or not the preamp is turned on or off when they make the dynamic range measurement is important. Sometimes they forget to tell you that in the measurement data. Particularly the manufacturer will always turn off the preamp when he tells you about dynamic range, but he may not say that. He may make the mistake of thinking the dynamic range you read is with the preamp turned on. If you're a serious 2-meter sideband guy, you always want to use that preamp because you want to listen to weak signals. So knowing whether it's there can be important. You got to know.
Basically, okay, this is KTKEY, so let's make it, you know, basically how to understand this. Basically, just look to see if the filters are on and off, and standard, like I say, is the standard at the laboratory, I believe, now is for a number of years now since they've gone into, I can say, this big lab at the ARRL. I know they have a great piece of equipment. Hewlett-Packard spectrum analyzers, Hewlett-Packard noise source, phase noise generator. I think they use that. I think I remember that back then, using the 8640T, I think they were using. So that's a standard. So now you know that that's standard there. Now the only thing you have to do is look to see filters on, filters off. What's the measurement on the piece of equipment, and then look at the offset frequency. Look at the attenuation. That will be called usually A1 in dB. And then look at the ratio of B2 to B1. And then they will give you at the end a phase noise in ADC per hertz. And now what you do is you take that and you look at that data and compare it to those transceivers in that market. In other words, in that group that you want to pay that X amount of money to see which one has the best characteristics for that group. In other words, which one of the number of radios you're looking at that you can afford. So pick out. In other words, get the most for your buck, the most bang for your buck. I think that's the simplest way to put it, Dick. Over.
Yeah. Don't expect to completely understand these lab reports immediately. I think if you go to the ARRO website, I believe they've got a explanation article that tells you how to get better understanding of what the lab report individual measurements means, which ones are important to you. If you're a person who lives out in the boondocks and there are no strong signals nearby that are going to give you dynamic range problems, then you may only care about sensitivity and whether or not the preamp has a low enough noise figure. By comparison, if you're a person that lives in Tokyo, where there's a ham radio operator on every corner, and you're in a major metropolitan area with lots and lots of strong signals, strong signal tolerance is more important to you than sensitivity. That's the main reason why many of the Southeast Asia manufactured receivers, when you buy them in their native form, arrive in the United States in a state that we call gain starved. There's very little preamplification gain in the front end because strong signal tolerance at their country of origin is much more important than sensitivity. We don't have quite that problem in most of the areas when it drops in the United States, so the first thing we do is add a preamplifier to the front end of the receiver in order to pick up the sensitivity that we consider important. So you're sort of tailoring the rig for the environment it's going to go into. If you then go to a field day operation or a mountain topping operation during a VHF contest, and you're going to have 10 transmitters all within 50 feet of you, and they're all banging away at a kilowatt, you may change your attitude. In fact, the guys up at W2SZ Portable 1 at Mount Greylock, run by Dick Fry, can't think of Dick Fry's call letters right now, he has put every year a huge amount of effort to make sure he is using receivers that have the highest possible dynamic range. That's part of the reason why in the last 30 years, probably 28 of those years, he won the VHF contest either nationwide or on all of the East Coast, because he concerns himself with the dynamic range and other characteristics of every piece of equipment that they use in that operation. That's part of the reason that operation is so extremely successful year after year after year. K2KD1, K2LIW.
This is the K2KDY, all right. Let's see. So we try a couple more.
Go for it.
I guess I'm reading down the list here. I'm trying to pick out from young ham to new ham. They all usually mention that they just got into ham radio and some things they don't quite understand. So basically, I've tried, you know, like I say, my hunting tech on the keyboard is not the greatest. So it's hard for me many times to put it in simple words, and that's what I'm trying to do, is keep this stuff as simple as possible. Because I can say the first time you hear it, it's a lot of very, very complicated stuff to understand, and it takes sometimes a number of explanations. As Dick just mentioned, go to the ARRL, they may be able to define a little bit more how to make measurements and all in other terms. Alright, here's one. What is actually meant by a loaded cue of a circuit? Okay, see you, Dick, over.
Alrighty. Most of us, when we build a tuned circuit, we start off with an inductor and a capacitor. We put the capacitor across the inductor. And now once you know the inductance is Henry's and the capacitance is farad, you plug it into a formula. And the formula says the frequency of resonance equals 1 over 2 pi square root of LC. L times C. Square root, multiply by 2 pi, 1 over, that's the frequency in hertz. And you can make variations of that formula where you use microhenries and picofarads instead of farads and henries. But once you know how to adjust those values, that shows you the frequency of resonance. Once you've got that coil and that capacitor together and they've got that resonance, you could, if you want to, bring your Q multi, your Q dipper. What do we call that now? Q dipper? What do we call it? That device that measures frequency of resonance. Now, all of a sudden, my mind's going blank on it.
Grid dip oscillator?
PDO.
Give that man a cigar. Grid dip oscillator. That's it. So, you take this oscillating circuit, you bring it nearby, and the magic of wireless is that whenever two coils that are resonating, two resonant circuits are near each other, they'll couple energy from one to the other. They can be a couple of inches apart, maybe even a foot apart in some cases. So you bring your grid dip oscillator, which is oscillating on that very frequency, and you've got a field strength meter on the grid dip oscillator, the GDO, and as you bring your GDO close to this inductor and capacitor that's sitting on your bench, you'll notice that the field strength meter on your grid dip oscillator moves to the left. It tells you that energy is being sucked out. Well, energy is being sucked out because there is a resonator nearby on that exact frequency. So by twisting the dial and finding out where you get the least amount of S meter deflection on your grid dip oscillator, you find the resonant frequency. And when you do that, you're measuring unloaded resonant frequency. And if you know how to do it right, you find out how far you can go up in frequency and down in frequency before you get a given amount of loss of deflection, and you're measuring the bandwidth of that circuit. Every real inductor has a little bit of resistance in series with it. Every real capacitor has a little bit of series resistance. So therefore, the circuit is not perfect. If the circuit was perfect, it would have a unloaded Q. I'll explain what that means in a minute. That would be a very high number, close to a million, so to speak. Every real inductor has got some resistance. Every real capacitor has got some resistance. So therefore, your circuit has a little bit of loss built into it, and it's got a little bit more bandwidth than it would have if it was perfect. However, you've now got this great inductor and capacitor sitting on your table, and it's got this great resonant frequency, but nothing is connected to it. It can't, in most cases, you can't use it that way. If you're going to use it as a front-end filter between your antenna and your receiver, you're going to have to make connections to it. Okay? You might connect the antenna by connecting the coax cable one turn up on that coil. Maybe it's a 10-turn coil, and you put the bottom of the coil onto a shielded piece of a printed circuit board as the ground, and when you connect the shield to your coax cable there, and the center conductor taps into the coil one turn up. It now coupled energy from the antenna into your resonant circuit. Your receiver, you're also going to couple one turn up, and maybe you do it on the other side. In other words, on the north side of the coil, you connect the antenna one turn up. On the south side of the coil, you connect approximately one turn up the receiver, a piece of coax cable going into the receiver. You now You've now created a bandpass filter, an RF bandpass filter, for your receiver. By making this resonator on the right frequency, connecting your antenna into an input connector on the coil and capacitor, and your receiver on the output side. That's the good news. However, your antenna is a 50-ohm resistor at the frequency where it's designed to operate. Your receiver is close to a 50-ohm resistor. So you've now put a shunt 50-ohm resistor on the one turn up on the input end of the coil, and you've connected the equivalent of another 50-ohm resistor on the output side of this network, one turn up, going to the receiver. It's another 50-ohm resistor. The presence of those two new 50-ohm resistors are a load to that capacitor and inductor resonator. It now has a brand new bandwidth. It became more broadband. You loaded it down. It's a little bit like saying, my bell has a certain ring time, it's got a certain native cue to it, but if I hold my hand against a certain portion of the bell, when I hit it with a clapper, it doesn't ring as long. My hand is a load. My hand is a damping factor. The bell doesn't ring as long, doesn't ring as loud, doesn't sound quite the same when my hand is against it. the same thing is happening to this inductor, capacitor, resonator. You've now added a load on the input and a load on the output, and so now it's got a little bit more insertion loss, it's got a little bit broader bandwidth. So before you put the input and the output load on it, that was the unloaded Q when you made those measurements with the grid dip oscillator, and there's really ways of using a better laboratory equipment, an LCR meter, will really measure the quality of your resonator. But now that I've added the 50 ohm input and output resistor, I've now got a brand new performance. That's the loaded Q. And if I made the mistake of tapping the input antenna connection two turns up and the receiver two turns up, I've now created an increase in loading on the input and the output. I now have a bigger ratio between unloaded Q and loaded Q. My bandwidth of my filter is now more broad. That may be good news. And the insertion loss got lower. The insertion loss of a filter, in general, is a function of the loaded Q to unloaded Q ratio. If you can start off with a resonator that has a Q that is so high that when you load it down, you still have the performance you want in bandwidth, but you've got this great big ratio between loaded and unloaded Q, you're now going to have a very small insertion loss. That's the trade-off. Loaded Q to unloaded Q ratio is a trade-off between insertion, it's a trade-off between insertion loss and final bandwidth of the circuit. And so all of life is a compromise. Every resonator we use, we're using it in a slightly compromising situation. If you leave it alone and don't connect anything to it, it may have very high performance, but you're not getting much use out of it. If you make a heavy connection to it, you get very low insertion loss, but now you don't get very much filtering. And somewhere in between those two extremes is the happy medium you're looking for. And once you really start studying filtering, you realize you can have a little bit of your cake and eat it too. If you make a filter that has more than one resonator, if you make a filter with two resonators, they call it a two-pole filter. If you make a filter with four resonators, it's called a four-pole filter. And if you connect those four resonators together just right as a filter, you can get much higher performance if you start off with the right hardware. And that's a whole art and science itself for making Chebyshev filters, Butterworth filters, M-derived filters, constant K filters, equi-phase filters, so on. The subject of filters is an art and science all to itself. There are people who have spent a good fraction of a lifetime just learning all the ins and outs of filters. Crystal lattice filters. Mel put a big chunk of his life into making the world's best crystal lattice filter. K2KDY, K2LIW.
This is K2KDY. Don't remind me of the of that thing. I'm sorry, that thing was a nightmare. What went on with that thing? You know, something that when you get into, you want to pull your hair out of your head because of interaction and section that you keep going back and forth. You know, that after a while you get the shake from working on things like that. I can say it's a thing you can dedicate your life to. You still wind up a neurotic. Let me just say a few more words about Q. I think that they basically, what they're referring to, I know what this is on for the test, that Q, let's talk about Q, say, from below 30 megahertz. If you, for instance, frequencies that we're talking about, like below 30 megahertz, most of the resistance in a tuned circuit at below 30 is usually in what we call the resistance of the coil. So what they'll do, in many cases, the reactant, knowing that with the reactant, by increasing the turns of the, if I can put this in the right word, increasing the number of turns basically in a coil will increase the reactant faster than it will raise the resistance. In other words, you putting some more turns on the coil will make the reactance go up, but the measured resistance will be relatively small. I think I said that right, Dick, before I continue over.
Hey, you're now getting into the real definition of Q that I should have mentioned, and that is if you take the center frequency of your inductor capacitor resonator, and you also measure the bandwidth, the so-called 3dB bandwidth, you sweep it up from center and down from center, and find out that when you're using it as a filter, where it falls off to half power flowing through, that's called the 3dB bandwidth. If you take that 3dB bandwidth number, and let me give some exact examples. Let's assume I'm building a inductor capacitor resonator at 10 megacycles. And let's say that I now run a test with laboratory equipment, and I find out that when I tune half a megacycle high and half a megacycle low, let's make it a quarter megacycle. Quarter megacycle high and quarter megacycle low, those are the two places where it falls off to half power flowing through, 3dB loss. Half up, half down, 1 meg bandwidth. I ran quarter up, quarter down, half meg total bandwidth. So if I take the quarter meg, a half meg total bandwidth, divide it into the center frequency, 10 megacycles, I now have half divided into 10, the answer is 20. So that circuit has a Q of 20. So bandwidth divided by divided into center frequency is one of the definitions of Q. Because the inductor is almost always the major cause of the Q of the circuit, most people will talk about the Q of the inductor all by itself. That's what Mel was telling you. And therefore, if you take the inductive reactance divided by the resistance, that's another definition of Q of that inductor. Let me drop. Now, Mel was giving you the example of if you double the number of turns, and if you've got a really good physical layout of a inductor, when you double the turns, and if all the flux links all of the turns, the magnetic field links all of the turns, double the turns gives you a square of the inductor. Double the turns would be four times the inductor. But double the turns is only twice the length of the wire, so therefore you've only double the resistance, but you've got four times more inductance by doubling the number of turns. So therefore, in this ideal coil that Mel and I are now winding, doubling the turns doubles the resistance, but quadruples the reactance. The Q of the coil is reactance divided by resistance. It just doubles the Q of the coil by adding more turns, as long as you've got an ideal layout so that all the magnetic fields links all the turns of this coil. Toroids can do this. Some carefully wound air coils can do this. So quite often when you look at any of the components you can buy these days, particularly microwave components, they'll tell you the Q of the coil at a particular frequency or a band of frequency, and they'll tell you the frequency at which the Q is maximum. They'll also tell you the self-resonant frequency of the coil. Almost every coil has a little bit of capacitance between the turns and a little bit of capacitance between the ends. So even before you add a capacitor, there's a certain frequency where you can't easily go beyond, and the so-called self-resonant frequency of the coil. So a simple coil of wire as an inductor in air or around the ferrite, let me drop, you can have a whole fancy data sheet on it as to what is the Q on each frequency. For that, you can find out how good a filter it's going to make, what kind of bandwidth you're going to get, what insertion loss you're going to get. You can decide if that particular inductor is good enough for your purpose, and if it's still small enough that it won't fit into your circuit. One of the rubs of making high-Q coils is that it takes real estate. Well, nowadays, everybody wants everything to be miniature. So as you start shrinking down the size of the coil and doing the resonating, you're losing some performance. And really crafty manufacturers have found ways of giving you almost the same performance in a smaller package. And they prove it to you by giving you a data sheet telling you what the Q is at all of these individual frequencies. They'll tell you the maximum current it can tolerate. If you to send bias current into the collector of a transistor through that coil. There's lots and lots of information you can get if you go to the right spot. Go to the right website, and you look at Coilcraft, for instance. This is one of my favorite brand names. Coilcraft makes some beautiful air-round microwave coils. I use them like they're going out of style, for balance and impedance matching and all kinds of things. That's a 1,000 megacycles. Millen used to be another company that made some really good coils. Air Duct is another brand name that way back in my day, Air Duct made some great coils, air-wound coils that held together with plastic rods, and you could use them as loading coils in dipole antennas, trap dipole antennas. I bet you Mel's got a few stories on one of those. KQKEY, KQLIW.
KB2HWW with a comment on the subject, please.
Okay, go ahead, Howie, with your comment, and then pass it over to Mel.
My comment is this. You need to make it very clear that the difference between series resistance and loading the resistance across an IF circuit. That means in a coil, as you know, you just said it, is X of L divided by R. The lower the resistance, the higher the Q of the circuit is, obviously, but the quality of the circuit. But if you're putting a load across a parallel circuit, like an IF transformer, if you go into a lower impedance amplifier, the Q goes down, and you want to go into a high impedance, and it's R divided by X of L. If you've got a parallel resistance, or if you've got series resistance, there's two formulas, and you've got to be careful of that. Back to you, then.
And to take that one step further, whenever you put a resistor and a capacitor and an inductor together as a parallel network, there is, at that frequency and that frequency only, an exact equivalent where you make a slightly different inductor, a slightly different size capacitor, and a slightly different size resistor, but now they're all in series with each other instead of all in parallel. At that frequency, they act the same. I can have two black boxes side by side. One back black box, I've got an L, a C, and an R, all in parallel. And if I'm smart enough, in the second black box, I put the L, the C, and the R in series, but they're different values. And if you don't allow me to sweep in frequency, at that one frequency where I did this equivalency calculation, you make the measurements on the outside of that black box, you can't tell which is which until you start sweeping the frequency. So as long as you're smart enough not to try to do it broadband, there's an exact equivalent for every parallel and every series network. And Howie is giving you a hint about that, that when it comes to how you're going to use that inductor, there's one way you can calculate the Q for parallel, and another way you can calculate the Q for a series. But once you understand that Q is quality factor, which has something to do with bandwidth and insertion loss, you know, something about the compromises that you're, as an engineer, you're going to be doing when you design these kind of circuits. This is not going to make a whole lot of sense the first time you hear it. I know that. You're going to have to hear it a few times. You're going to have to read a few articles on it.
The thing is, you want to also realize that you have to look at the phase angle. Now, when your 3 dBs are down 45 degrees, if you're working on a filter network, you may want to do a, you know, bandwidth per phase plot. And you know that comes into the R, that the real and imaginary impedances, plus, you know, as resonance, you know, currents and voltages are in phase. So you really want to look at the phase angle.
Another one of the measurements. And on top of that, every filter has something called group delay characteristics. Some people call it group delay distortion. In other words, the amount of time it takes for the signal to flow through your filter. You would think it's always going to be the same if you haven't changed the design. Well, you're going to have one amount of time it takes for the signal to flow through the filter if it's at the frequency of the center frequency of your filter, and you'll have a slightly different performance at the high end and the low end frequency of the filter. And you can make a plot of that, delay time through the filter versus frequency. And on things like television circuits, that can be very important because the time delay difference represents the phase shift, and if you haven't properly compensated that phase shift, Jay Leno's face will turn green on that television set that you've just designed. And it's going to make your customer unhappy. There's a lot more to this, obviously. KQKEY, KQLAW.
This is KQKEY. Well, we're getting a little too much into complication here. Let me try to get this back down to a level of a fairly new ham. Let's talk about your transmitter. We're talking about an HF transmitter. The energy, or we could say, yeah, I guess we could call it the energy, that is delivered to the final, from the final amplifier into a resonant circuit in a transmitter. The energy that is consumed by the circuit itself is very small. Most of the energy actually is consumed by the load. So what happens in a transmitter, why, how we get to this? We know the specification of the Q of the circuit that we're looking for. So what we do now, we now design the circuit around it. And you will find that many places, because as Dick said, you've got to take up a lot of real estate when you start with the inductances, making the inductances, getting larger inductances, takes up more real estate. What they'll do in many cases, you'll have a large capacitance and a small inductance, and you'll come out with Q in the same place. So, once you know the design of the loaded Q of the amplifier, then it's a matter of designing the component. And as Howie touched upon, there is a formula. Let me let it drop. Just touch upon the formula just for a second, because first time hearing it, it's a little difficult. But the Q, let me see if I can put it in right words, the Q of a parallel resonant circuit that is loaded by what we call a resistive impedance. That is the Q of L, where QL is the loaded circuit Q, equals the RL, that's the parallel load resistance in ohm, divided by the X value, which is usually the inductance ohm of either the inductor or the capacitor. So in other words, that's what I'm saying, you take these two, the inductance and the capacitance, put them together, determine the Q of the circuit. I think that's the simplest way I can put it, Dick, over.
I agree with that. Do you know that Q is something to do with quality factor? Q is usually important when it comes to the inductor. Most of the time, it's not as important when you're talking about the capacitor. It is usually important when you talk about the inductor capacitor combined as the resonator, the filter, the thing that does the tuning. And Q has got approximately four definitions. Don't have to memorize them, just know that they're there. One definition of Q is bandwidth divided into center frequency. Another definition of Q is the current rise at resonance. The series network will have off resonance, a certain current that flies through it, but the current multiplies a certain number of times when you hit resonance. That's another definition of Q. Another definition of Q for a parallel circuit is voltage rise at resonance. And there's a fourth definition, which I can't think of right now, but it'll come to me later. So these are various ways of telling you something about what to expect when you use that particular brand of a coil in a resonating network, whether it be part of the tank circuit of your transmitter, let me drop, or the RF filter at the front end of the receiver, or whether it be the filter that's in the IF strip. Knowing the Q, the quality factor of the component, loaded, unloaded, what bandwidth to expect, what current rises to expect, what voltage rises to expect. You can talk about the Q of a dipole antenna, how much the voltage rises at the tips of the dipole versus to what you've applied to the meter, which is a function of how long is the dipole. When you make your dipole short and re-resonate it, by either loading coils or the antenna tuner, the Q increases. Therefore, your antenna becomes more narrow band. Everything with higher Q is more narrowband. So you can talk about the Q of your dipole, it's your method of constructing it, and it's going to give you a hint about how much bandwidth you can use it over before your transmitter becomes unhappy. As I said, you don't have to know all of these things, but slowly it'll all make a little more sense as you stick with this hobby. And there's a lot to be gained from it, even though at first it seems like there's a whole lot of terms. Boy, the first time you talk about resonant network, you talk about impedance, which is made out of resistance and reactance. Now, why don't you go over to the next subject, because I think we've gone a little too deep on this one. We've gone a little bit too far off of what the original person asked. KQJY, K2RAW.
Most definitely, this is K2JY. All right, I'm not going to get into things. I was going to get into what they call... you have to read about it, because there is another factor called the parallel load resistance in circuits and how it affects six spotters, say, how it changes the Q, but at the same time changes the bandwidth and sometimes the power resistance, say, in the IF circuit to increase the bandwidth, how they will load the Q down with a resistor. But that's getting off the deep end a little too much, Dick. So should we go on with one more? See if we get one more in, over.
Yeah, I think if we're careful, we'll squeeze in one more. If we keep going too deep, if you know what I mean.
Get in too deep. You can't hear you. I'm trying to keep this simple. This is what they basically have asked me a number of times, that we keep continuing with my simple explanation. So, basically, you know, just trying to give them an insight into really what it is. But like you say, the first time you hear this, you're going to hear all this stuff, and we're going to get into all kinds of fancy definitions of Q and its applications. You know, you're never going to understand it, really. There's too much to gather in one shot. All right, I'm looking again. Hold on. Okay, here's one. Also from another young ham. I can tell by the call letters. Really issue. One of the questions pool is Severin theorem. That's not really complicated. All right, the name is more complicated than it is. It determines, you know, the resistance to explain or answer question on Severin's theorem. You want to take a quick shot at that, over?
I usually start off with a battery. That flashlight battery, a C cell, a D cell, a AA, AAA, quadruple A. Each one of those batteries, if you put a direct short circuit across it with a current meter, gives you a different amount of current. In the case of a D cell, you might see 8 amperes flowing into a dead short. In the case of a AAA, maybe you're going to see half an ampere. In each case, the battery itself, when it's brand new and you measure it with a good meter, you're going to measure something like 1.55 or 1.60 volts out of both of them. So if I had two black boxes side by side and I did nothing but measure voltage, I'd say they're identical, even though one contains a AAA cell and one contains a D cell, delta cell. Because one of them is capable of dishing out more current, you can tell that inside of the battery, there really is a different equivalent circuit. So I could make a model of the battery. In the first case, that the D cell is going to be a 1.5 volt ideal voltage source, something that never changes, but it's got a resistor in series with it. And maybe the resistor is an eighth of an ohm. That's a 7 equivalent circuit for that D cell. Eighth of an ohm resistor in series with a 1.6 volt ideal voltage source. You put that in a black box, and if one of them contains the 7 equivalent circuit, the other one contains an ideal D cell, an ordinary D cell, you can't tell the difference. That's what Severin said. He said for every power supply, every source of signal, you can make equivalent, you can make it act like its ideal voltage generator, AC or DC, in series with a resistor. Choose the right magnitude of the battery or voltage generator, choose the right series resistor, and now you can make a schematic diagram out of that that'll always tell you what the right answer is. I mean, to try to put a D-cell battery into your schematic diagram, let me drop, and make it behave like the real world is not easy until you make a Thevenin equivalent circuit of that D-cell battery or that AAA battery. Now your circuit will behave like the real battery. T2KEY, T2LAW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. All right, let me see if I can put it into words. I've used it before. In engineering, many times it is useful to basically stick with just trying to say in so many words. I'm simplifying an electrical circuit. So the Theravent actually is a useful way of simplifying it. Let me see if I can give another example. Let's say you had a battery and you have a resistor in series with the battery. Then you have another two resistors that are in parallel and then go back to the battery. In other words, you start at the positive of the battery with the connector resistor. Then we go on and we take two more resistors, but they're in parallel and in series. In other words, the two resistors are parallel together, but they go in series with the first resistor that we had on the battery. And that returns back to the negative of the circuit. Now, if we wanted to just basically, very simple circuit, we wanted to simplify it, the first thing we would do is take those two parallel resistors that are in series with that first resistor, and we would determine the resistance, the joint resistance of those two resistors. And now we would have only, instead of three resistors in the circuit, if we restore it, we actually will have only two resistors. So now, that's a sample of simplifying, very simple example of simplifying a circuit. How does that sound, Dick? Over.
That's a beauty. You'd be amazed how many networks you could have when you've got a whole lot of R's and C's and L's.
Repeat, R, S, E.
You got a whole bunch of components that run all over them. And in many cases, you can boil it down to a much simpler circuit that behaves in the identical manner. And these Thevenin equivalent circuits help you do that. You Google that word, Thevenin, T-H-E-V-E-I-N-I-N, I think it is, or Thevenin equivalent circuit. Guarantee Google is going to have a zillion articles on it, and at least one of them by Berkeley College is going to put it into a nice, easy paragraph with a beautiful diagram that's going to tell you what it all means. Thank you, Mel.
I've explained these things a number of times, you know, in front of young groups, and also I try to give, you know, make drawings, simple drawings like that, using, you know, three resistors. And reducing is showing you can make it down. I can say you can get a circuit that has passive and everything else thrown all over the place. You sit there and you're scratching your head out of heck, like, determine what the heck this conglomerate is. And you redraw it down to a simplified circuit, and you'd be amazed how much time you'll suddenly say, there's my answer, what it's all about. So Theravent was just a, what would be a mathematician, I believe, Dick, over.
I'm not sure, but I would call him a mathematician engineer, because he certainly did that. I use that set of formulas of his, so to speak, almost every day in the work that I do in my RF engineering. Okay, they're going to turn the machine off in about 2 minutes. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1195. 1195 of the series that began in September of 1982. We're coming up on 26 years. Craziness. Apparently there's some more questions out there to be answered, so Mel and I, if we stay healthy, we'll be back next week and try to do more of the same. 73 you all. Be kind to each other. Bye-bye for now. Mel, K2KEY, you got it.
Hey, this is K2KEY. All right, we'll try to keep it. I will make an effort to keep this group here. I'm going to put you all on attention and getting into very complicated electronic terms, and I'll try to simplify it, but as Dick said, you can always Google any one of these terms and look at it. I know sometimes it's very difficult to understand it. Believe me, I didn't get it, and I don't think Dick did. Let's put it this way. We weren't born knowing all this stuff, so don't give up. I know I've heard this from a number of people. It's a little too much. I said, no, it's just got to take it step by step. It's like looking at when you're a little kid and you're looking at people running by and here you're trying to stand up to walk, you know. It seems like an impossible accomplishment. But the same thing with this. If you work at it after a while, you'll say, you know, oh, now I know what it's about. So don't give up, really. It's a challenge. But it's a lot of fun, and it's also great for you to really, you know, accomplish something that you can be proud of. 73 goal, and we'll try to do it again next week. Take care, everybody. This is Pete, Steve, and Wyatt.